this is a cagey work, I think. And so my sort of prologue or introduction is going to be a little bit long-winded, but it does lead to a question. You know, when I listen to the narrator and I read the narrator, it sounds to me like he's making a deposition. He's wanting us to hear and read the reasons he did what he did. So he's kind of laying it out for us. He had this encounter, this singular encounter with this person, Bartleby. And so as I read it, as I read through it, at first I find him funny, absurd, kind of a phony. A phony.
Which one, the narrator?
The narrator. But as I go on, I realize every kind of argument, I think, well, here's how you could have treated Bartleby differently. He comes up with, he answers that question for me. Whether it's Christian compassion, or just let Bartleby stay. Anything you can think of, this narrator has thought of in trying to deal with Bartleby. And now we go back to the beginning. He's had his experience, now he's telling us from the beginning. And he's a man who's sensitive, as he says, to the opinions of others. So he's sensitive to our opinion as we read his story. And so we're the jurors, in a way, listening to his story. And as I've listened to it and gone over it several times, the thing that appears to me is that he sees Bartleby as a problem to be solved. And so my question is really the only question that Bartleby asks of him is, instead of what should the narrator do, what does Bartleby want him to see?
Want him to seek?
Want him to see.
See, because that's the question. He says, can you not see for yourself?
Can you not see? So on page 127 in my book, but it's difficult because everybody's got different things, so I'll just read it. And this is the narrator speaking. "Why, how now? What next?" exclaimed I. "Do no more writing?" "No more." "And what is the reason?" Bartleby says, "Do you not see the reason for yourself?" He indifferently replied. Now the narrator goes on to say, well, this probably is to do with the fact that I've overworked him, and it has to do with his eyes, perhaps. But if this is a story of Wall Street, and the official title of the story, short story, is Bartleby the Scrivener, A Story of Wall Street. So as A Story of Wall Street, what does Bartleby want us to see? What does he want the narrator to see? That's my question.
Can I answer with a long response, Marilyn? First of all, I found the narrator almost as odd or strange as Bartleby, because on the surface, this would be a simple problem. You have an employee, and he refuses, and what you do is you fire the person, right? Somebody is, you're the employer, he's the employee. You have to ask him to do something, he refuses. You fire him, he refuses to get out and call the police. I mean, it's a simple, on the surface, that's what the landlord, the other next landlord does, in effect. It takes the next landlord to get. But somehow or other, this guy, his will is paralyzed. We don't know why, but he gives all kinds of reasons. And even he talks about providence at some point. And I don't think he ever comes to understand why he can't just simply assert himself and say, get out.
I kind of thought about that.
See, his will seems to be paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Bartleby is concerned, it just occurred to me, because I didn't understand Bartleby at all, but maybe that passage completely escaped me. What Bartleby was seeing was the futility of existence. And you can just imagine what it would be like to spend your life copying legal briefs. I can't imagine anything more mechanical and more boring.
Financial reports.
Yeah, a lot of things.
And even the other people.
The same financial report.
The other Dickensian characters. By the way, he took this idea from a story by Dickens, which had been serialized in New York papers in 1853, and did his own take on it. But the other characters in the office are, I would imagine, are Dickensian characters, but they're also reacting in a way to the same monotonous quality of existence, but they don't go as far as Bartleby. Bartleby seems to not want to live. Sees the futility of things.
I don't know whether that quite answers Mr. Crotty's question. The only thing I would, I'm not sure it advances us at all, but I don't know how much weight to attribute to that adverb, but I'm not sure that Bartleby wants the narrator to see anything. Remember, he says this indifferently. It's not a proselytizer or a dead wall reveries or something like this.
It seemed to me that the implication was that, it struck me at some point in the story that the narrator and Bartleby really are oddly alike in some ways. Neither one actually appears to have a life. And they're both stuck at desks most of their days facing a wall. None of these windows have views. Wall Street has eliminated all perspective on the outer world, and they both spend their days, as far as we can tell, doing mindless activities of one kind or another, not being terribly reflective about the outside world, and not having a visible life outside of these offices. And the narrator doesn't seem to me, except for his little trip in his carriage, just to sightsee, to be very different. And maybe Bartleby was saying, don't you see that you're like me? And isn't maybe that the reason why the narrator clung to the hope of taking care of Bartleby somehow?
Well, the narrator, instead of being consumed by pity, has a more interesting job than Bartleby, but he likes to do the easy thing. He had a sinecure job before, and then that job was eliminated, and now he's some kind of a solicitor on Wall Street. But he always takes the easy way out, and he's taking, I guess, the easy way out with Bartleby is just do nothing.
But even as I thought it was interesting that the point was made that the narrator's work, as far as I could understand it, doesn't involve anything thought that demands thought.
There's no law in him. He doesn't do lawyering.
He's a scribe, basically.
Right. He does nothing really. He is a correlative of Bartleby, and he begins. Well, it said he begins the discourse by saying, "I like the easy way out, and I don't go before a law court, which would be scary for him." And he had this job in Chancery, which was just money in his pocket, as he says. So he and Bartleby is paid by this man, but it's the world that's paying the lawyer who writes this piece. It just falls in his lap. And so he says, when I come down Wall Street, the gay Mississippi, he says, all these colors and lights, of course, he can witness, and Bartleby witnesses the wall. The thing about Wall Street is that it could be a pun on the walls that surround, probably is some sort of, because there's a wall everywhere that people who try to look out on, they never see the street. You have to go out onto Wall Street properly to see the world.
Can you
also say that maybe the narrator, lives by prescription. He has a whole lot of prescriptions for his life about going to church, about what pity means, how he works in the easiest possible way. And then comes this person into his life who doesn't live by any prescription that he can measure. And you can see the description of the three other Scriveners who all, while they may have their reactions to things that go to a certain boundary, but ultimately they follow the prescription that's been set up and that the narrator lives, so that when you have somebody like Bartleby who comes in there, there's no answer to what he's doing. So,
and the other interesting thing about when he was going to church is that when he gets unsettled by his experience with Bartleby,
he doesn't go.
Everything flattened. Exactly.
Because
there's a word he uses. What's that one? He says, I was unable to, it's like he was no longer pure enough. I don't quite remember. Does anybody have that one? Just the phrase, you know, I was unable to.
From many years of childhood of observing people going to church who tended to sleep through sermons and that sort of thing, while I was sitting in the choir,
disqualified.
Disqualified.
Did not accomplish the purpose I had seen. The things I had seen disqualified me from church.
Well, there are two things that go with that. What I was thinking was more, I'm not calm enough to go to church. I don't have my mask on. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't look just the way I should, because this is all part of what the mask I present to the world, so that I get so that I have a social position.
Disgruntled by the whole thing makes it unable to present the facade that he should be presenting.
But when you bring up the actual word disqualified, that kind of reminds me of that passage in Matthew where Jesus says that you're not fit to go to the altar if you're angry at your brother. You have to go and reconcile with him first.
Mm-hmm. But he doesn't seem to be angry in this instance.
No.
He seems to be pitying, which would seem to be an appropriate state
of
mind.
But he thinks there's something inappropriate about what he's done. I mean, he seems guilty all the time about Bartleby. And I think it's that sense of guilt.
He keeps talking about... this gentleman, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, said, you know, why didn't he just fire him? But he always seems from the beginning to feel like some sort of obligation toward him. I had a feeling that might have something to do more with the more old-fashioned kind of employment when it was their apprenticeship and, you know, that a job was only partly a job, it was your life, and that, I don't know, that was putting
things... Well, he gave a very good reason for it. Mm-hmm. He gave a very good reason for it. This was a very easy way to give himself the luxury of being good to somebody.
Well, there's that, but also, if you look at it, when Bartleby was working, he worked very, 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 very well. He was extremely efficient. And his other employees, one was okay in the morning and the other one was okay in the afternoon, mm-hmm. but forget about them at the opposite times, and you know, there was always something going on with all of them.
He always has reasons, and they're always different, which makes you suspect there's something else going on him.
Who has reasons?
The lawyer, yeah.
Has reasons for...
not firing.
Yeah, good. And I go back to the disqualification concern.
Right.
The disqualification might be that the lawyer has a truly Christian experience.
Right.
And can't go to church. He's witnessing not the Christ, but something akin to the Christ who doesn't eat or take thought for the morrow and goes into reveries, but who doesn't preach, but in some way is the, I don't want to say superior, but the lawyer has to in some way look up rather than down or straightforward to Bartleby. And the others don't see that. The lawyer sees that. And this experience with Bartleby en route to church stops him in his tracks.
Right.
You can't go to church after that.
It's like he's caught.
Yes.
Like somehow, you know, Bartleby has arrested his
Absolutely.
Routine. his philosophy, his way of solving problems. You know, John Jacob, you know, the John Jacob Astor quote I love at the beginning. It's so humorous, you know, because he says, oh, yes, and I'm not insensitive to John Jacob Astor's opinion of me. And John Jacob Astor says, you know, two salient features of the man, of the narrator.
Prudent
and method.
And method, yes.
You know, so those are the two singular features of the man, and those are the two things that seem to be getting him in trouble with Bartleby.
And also when
because
that
he's prudent, and his method of dealing with him is not working.
Right. He says passive-aggressive or something like that on passive. Right. But in that paragraph, the lawyer uses, he says, not insensible, and not, he uses the double negative on three occasions within a single paragraph. That is that he both is and he isn't. He can't say, I'm sensible of his opinion. I'm not insensible. So it's always deferential to some authority that will speak for him.
But he plays this game throughout the whole thing where he has kind of incredible subtle irony about it. Like where you can almost hear him saying, you know, I'm not insensitive to this man, John Jacob Astor, that is my benefactor primarily. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's this sort of honesty, he says, you know, and he's very honest about his greed or his love of the easy life. He tries to give us this impression that he's being a very honest person about himself all the time, you know, by giving us these little tidbits, right? So we, in a way, can absolve him.
Well, maybe it's God. It's the deposition, not through us. It's to God, through us, the readers, that he is appealing by giving all these various facets that make up one contradictory account.
Mr. Brody, when you say did you say innocent? Or that he's not, I guess, what's his crime? So what guilt? And there's been a lot of things that I've heard people say that he seems guilty. What's the essence of that?
Well, that's what he's trying to figure out. He himself is trying to figure that out. He knows that legally he's not guilty of any crime, but it's like he's constantly asking himself, at what point do I become Pontius Pilate? At what point have I crossed the line? I mean, at what point have I sinned against another son of Adam? And he's trying to figure out, what is he guilty? He has definitely within him an uneasiness that he might be in a position of power and he might be unjust. And that's still
I think that he gives us the answer in the paragraph just before he decides that he is not qualified for church. And he says, to a sensitive being, pity is not seldom pain. And when at last it is perceived that such pity cannot lead to effectual succor, common sense bids the soul rid of it. Well, common sense tells him, give up this pity. What I saw that morning persuaded me that the scrivener was the victim of innate and incurable disorder. I might give alms to his body, but his body did not pain him. It was his soul that suffered, and his soul I could not reach. So when he finally realizes, you know, I can't really do what this man needs to relieve his pain, he says, there I stop.
Right. I guess if I was understanding God correctly, it seemed to me that his offense might be that he was overly solicitous, that he was not, if I'm understanding that, you know, I thought your question was, why is he putting up with this? I mean, because as I read it, I definitely understand that he has that qualm. But as I look at the events of the story, I'm looking at someone who, when Bartleby refuses to copy, he says, okay, well, you don't really need to go over the copy. You know, when it refuses to review copy, he says, Bartleby is exempted from that. Then the next thing is Bartleby won't copy at all. And eventually he says, well, you'll have to leave. But he gives him a very gracious, from what I can understand, a generous severance, a much more generous severance than usual. For total malfeasance, right? Total refusal to do his job. And then he moves his offices rather than call the police, which I believe was your point. And then when he's finally carted off to prison, he's looking to bring the man food and to keep him alive. So I definitely hear that he seems to feel guilty. But when I look at his actions, he's bending over backwards doing more than doing nothing. He's taking a whole bunch of positive actions to try to maintain this man that he's got a bond with.
But right, the part that you read is actually where he feels the evil that's waiting inside of him. You know, he says at some point melancholy merges into fear and that pity into repulsion. Mm-hmm. And this reminds me, that lovely Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz, wrote articles urging the genocide of the Indians, that they be exterminated, because we have to feel sorry for them, but at some point they will never forgive us, and they will always be waiting to seek their revenge. So it's just better to put them all out of their misery and remove that from us. And so he feels, you know, that's what he's talking about here, that fear and pity will grow into revulsion, and then he feels then disqualified from going to church because of that evil that he senses in himself.
But I've worked with a number of people who have a complete inability to fire somebody, even for really egregious. I'm thinking of one person that I work with who had an employee who was actively stealing, both from the business and from the people who came. And it's a paralysis. Usually people give the excuse, well, I don't want my workman's compensation rates to go up. But it's not that. It's a paralysis. I can't assert myself in that way. I can't hurt somebody.
Well, that, I think, is key. Because at a certain point, he wants to fire Turkey. Mm-hmm. And then Turkey has this way of this shared irony with the narrator. And, you know, he says, with submission, sir, you know, and he gives some sort of entertaining thing where he's going to marshal the blah, 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 you know, and when I'm drunk in the afternoon, it's great because I'm this way. And he charms him. He says, well, I can't fire you. And there's a sort of sense of, like, common human feeling that even though there's this sterile cistern of an office, which is devoid, it's like desiccant, it's just devoid of what he sells. I think domestic feeling is, you know, the women are in the attic. That's the only woman in the store.
There's a bust of Cicero.
And there's a bust of Cicero. But the, you know, so it's devoid of human feeling. And so in a way, he can't fire because there's something still left in him. The humanness in him can't let him go. And so I guess the question then is, somehow this pallid, empty person is pulling this feeling out of this man.
But he does fire him several times, but Bartleby just doesn't leave.
But he can't rid himself in his mind of him.
He can't rid himself, but he does fire him. You said he can't fire him, and he does. I mean, he keeps firing him several times. You said he does it in your introductory statement. You said he does everything he can to get rid of him, but except he doesn't. He didn't do what the next landlord did, who came in and said, oh, there's a guy here. All right, we're calling the police. I mean, it took him a while. First, he tried to get somebody else to move him. But he, you know, he effectively got rid of him, which this guy just didn't. So that, you know, he obviously didn't try to get rid of him, but, you know, why?
But isn't it interesting that even the landlord, who you would think has no attachment to the man, doesn't just go in with the police, but sort of reaches for some other connection, like, here's your old employee. You have some connection to him. Reach him and pull him out rather than
the
office.
I wonder if there's a little bit more, historical difference between the way we treat employees and employers.
But I think that's Melville watching human beings. There's a scene in iRobot when Will Smith says, or somebody tells Will Smith, watch robots. You put them on. You think they're not human, but humanity just arises so naturally. You put them on a flatbed truck and they start moving closer to one another. And there's something about human beings, you just stand us next to one another and we do develop a fellow feeling. And I think that Melville really knows humans, you know, he was on the whaling ship, and he really knows what people, that they do bond, you know, people from all over.
I remember one of your bosses years ago said, well, you know, this place is not a charity. And that, in some way, I think is a very important thing about a very important part of the concept, that often people do have this feeling that I owe this person a lot. I have to help him. I can't hurt him.
In the Christian world, caritas is the ultimate social bond. That's sort of the name of the social bond, and it does seem to develop in anywhere that small groups of people, work together or do something together. And Melville, I think, goes to some lengths to describe the dynamics of these individuals and how they connect with each other. The little boy who's constantly going out and supplying the other guys, and how, you know, one guy is working in the morning and the other guy is good in the afternoon. And he brings Bartleby in and puts him in his own space, so that he's and gets to respect at least the work he does at the beginning. So I mean, he sort of describes how there are relationships that all four of these guys have that are not mechanical.
But it's only the lawyer who sees Bartleby. The others really don't see him as a, in any way other than an impediment. I think the lawyer has some awe for Bartleby that's mixed in with this feeling of caritas that he doesn't express explicitly to us.
But this caritas thing, I think, is a little too tidy, don't you think? Because if we just throw that out there and we say, okay, yeah, Bartleby's pulling on his heart, and oh, great, oh, wonderful, and that's wonderful, and yes, you should open your heart to the stranger, and blah, blah, blah. But that's not the problem that he presents.
It's because, a sense of awe about Bartleby, rather than a sense of fellow feeling.
He does say at one point, he says, "And more than all, I remembered a certain unconscious air of pallid, how shall I call it, a pallid haughtiness, say, or rather an austere reserve about him, which had positively awed me into my tame compliance with his eccentricities."
But the other thing that I really see about Bartleby, the first thing that strikes you about Bartleby is that he's depressed. But the second thing is he's passive-aggressive, kind of. I mean, he has a way of not doing what you want him to do and making it very difficult for you. And many, many, many people have a lot of trouble managing a passive-aggressive person.
Well, he really irks you.
Who?
Bartleby.
Well, because there's an employee in my office right now who is so much like him.
Your office.
It's interesting that we've been sort of asking whether...
And you can't fire him.
Well, I rent the services. I don't... Okay. The person doesn't answer directly to me.
I'm just kidding.
He always initiates.
It's interesting we've been asking whether viewing this through the lens of caritas is appropriate, but the one person that seems to me who's totally beyond any sort of feeling of charity is Bartleby. Bartleby doesn't engage in anything that is... I mean, I think one of the things that leaped out of me is the narrator at some point is saying something like, well, if Bartleby the phrase was ordinarily human, but Bartleby's not ordinarily human. And I thought, well, is the thing that Bartleby is not ordinary? That he's not human. Because there's something about him that's inhuman.
Bartleby is a mystery. What do we make of the last line? Ah, Bartleby, ah, humanity.
Yeah, well, we don't know whether he's saying the same thing twice or not.
It's wonderful because words fail him. I mean, he starts off so articulate at the beginning in this 19th century florid English, and at the end, it's like he's just reduced to him.
Yeah, but it didn't change him. Because at the end, you know, remember, he's telling this story, right, as it happened in the past. So as he's telling the story, he's telling what... The question about that last line to me is whether that last line is part of the story he's telling us, or somehow his narrative has been, in that moment, interrupted as he's recalling the story and having a kind of authentic expression of what he has just told.
Or is that the epiphany at the end?
Is that, yeah, is that kind of like, is, are we suddenly out of the story and he's at last being real before us?
See, I almost had the last line, I feel like laughing.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's not, because it has that quality about it, but at the, Mr. Farrelly's point, I was thinking, he's not, Bob Bartleby, our humanity is false. I mean, it's not about humanity at all. It's about inhumanity. It's about being awed by somebody who dares to live as either a beast or a god outside of society.
Well, which is more human, and then it's humane. And he's actually, the narrator is actually in some ways different from other humans because he is very humane.
Mm-hmm. But there's a question, I mean, I don't know, one thing that's just sort of odd, and I'm not exactly sure quite how this tallies, but the sort of deference that we do pay to each other's eccentricities when we have to work together and stuff. I mean, one of the sort of most obvious manifestations of this in otherwise is the silly nicknames that people have for each other, right? There's Turkey, there's Ginger Nut, there's Nippers, and so on. We don't know what they call their boss because presumably they don't call that to his face. But the Bartleby doesn't have one of them, right? He's always called Bartleby. In prison, however, he's called the Silent Man.
Actually,
there's a kind of attempt at assimilating him there that is possible, or at least superficially possible in prison, but not in the law.
So what do you make of the fact that the narrator has no name, no given name?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't know that the three other employees don't have a name for Bartleby. It's just not one that they've told the narrator, mm-hmm. or that he's...
Well, they also haven't told him his own, but yeah, so... But I don't know.
I bet they say a lot of things behind
sure.
his back.
Well, there's a partition. I mean, meant for it.
So let's just take stock. I mean, I'm trying to figure out... There's so many... We could go in a lot of different directions. So, actually, let's read this last paragraph. This is kind of still a question I have of whether... When I reread it, I had real emotion. I actually felt the tears that he was feeling. And the first time I read it, I thought he's full of crap, and this is part of his act. But yes, it's hard to read him one way because it seems like his whole portrait is double-sided. So, conceive a man by nature and misfortune, prone to a pallid hopelessness. Can any business seem more fitted to heighten it than that of continually handling these dead letters and assorting them for the flames? For by the cartload they are annually burned. Sometimes from out of the folded paper the pale clerk takes a ring. The finger it was meant for, perhaps, molders in the grave. A banknote sent in swiftest charity. He whom it relieved nor eats nor hungers any more. Pardon for those who died despairing. Hope for those who died unhoping. Good tidings for those who died stifled by unrelieved calamities. On errands of life, these letters speed to death. Ah, Bartleby, all humanity, I can't even say it, because it's sort of like the rhythm of that is just like, there's a sort of like, the movement of those lines is moving him as he's recalling it to a kind of, I can't define what that is, what he's come to, but the speed of it indicates to me a kind of revelation.
Definitely a revelation, because it's the framing device for the story as well, right? Because at the very beginning of the story, he says, I have not been able to ascertain anything about Bartleby from original sources, except for one apparently important fact that I'm going to tell you at the very end. So you're sort of set up to wait. It's like, wait for it. And it's a very odd fact to hang, it's the rosebud of the story, right? Because he's saying, the thing you really need to know about Bartleby is that he worked in the dead letter office. And then obviously there's more to it than that. But I was expecting so much more the first time through. I was expecting that's the reveal, is that he worked at, is that he used to work at a dead letter office, and you'd think you've been encountering him for days, but there is something bound up in that, and I'm struggling with it.
When I read that paragraph, what came to mind is kind of bizarre, and I can't remember the name of the movie, but that's one that's shown every Christmas with the Santa Claus who's put on trial. And the postman from the dead letter office, they're so upset about all of these Santa Claus letters that are being thrown out, and they say, let's take them over there, which is, you know, the great break that Santa Claus gets in the trial. But it's that same kind of fellow feeling for those dead letter people.
I have kind of a problem with that. And the thing is that you sort of brought this up, you know, there's such a difference between a first-person narrative story and a third-person selective omniscient-type narrative story. I mean, in this type of story, this guy has a very definite point of view. He has a personality. You know, he's not a pallid, you know, godlike narrator. And he's also writing it at one time. When you have the advantage when you're doing a third-person story of showing a progression of emotion. He can't show his own personal movement because he's writing this at one time. So at the beginning, he's starting out like, you think, oh God, this is just like your typical, like, you know, climber, you know, like the kind of guy who nowadays mentioned Donald Trump or Warren Buffett, you know, self-satisfied jerk. And at the end, he's got like this Shakespearean kind of, you know, floridity about the human existence and futility. And I really couldn't kind of, I really couldn't kind of reconcile that.
Well, there's a question, and I think it does get to Mr. Cardi's first question, that in other words, there's some kind of parallel here with this, of that very first passage you call to attention, where, you know, the narrator mistakenly assumes that Bartleby's talking about his eyes, right? And, you know, don't you see what the problem is? Well, you know, it must be about this guy's eyes. Now, then there's this passage where it's an open question, I think, to me, whether this deeply felt humaneness is, in fact, you know, adequately understanding Bartleby any better than the sort of coarsely, obviously, mistake about the eyesight one.
That's really helpful because, as you know, as you allude to, that after he makes the comments about the eyes, after that's his first supposition, and then Bartleby says, I'm not going to do this anymore, and the guy says, but what about when your eyes get better? And he says, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. So clearly it wasn't about the eyes at all, you know. So it's interesting. Your point is good in a way because it, like, starts from the physical. And then he goes, he says, well, the problem is in the soul. So he's gone through this whole trajectory of trying to explain as this other. Like, our Bartleby's the other. He's a specimen that he's going to figure out. And at the end, oh, I see, it's this dead letter situation, you know. But... And then we're caught up in a way, like, oh, he really does learn something, doesn't he, about Bartleby? But I'm sort of left with this question, is he still just full of crap? And that at the end of the day...
Which one of them
is? Is the narrator just full of it? And at the end of the day, like, that's not... This conclusion is not what Bartleby is wanting him to see.
Right. It's not what's there to be seen.
What's there to be seen is a better way to put it. Yeah.
I don't think Bartleby cares what is seen.
I agree with you.
There is at least a parallel, right? I mean, he was chased out of this. Well, according to rumor, anyway, he was chased out of this office with some kind of, you know, presidential campaign, this foil system, the Jacksonians went out, and, you know, I guess, I don't know, Zachary Taylor came in or something. Right, but this is parallel to what happened to the narrator with the New York City Constitution or New York State Constitution. So there's a kind of avenue towards fellow feeling there, but it may be quite factitious. I mean, he's looking for what caused him to suffer, not nearly so deeply, I suppose. But maybe this helped me understand Bartleby, but it's really not clear to me that that's an adequate explanation of what's happening in Bartleby. It's moving, but I don't know.
Maybe the important thing is that he's trying to understand Bartleby, and he's desperately trying to understand what made Bartleby the way he was, whereas at the beginning of the story, the narrator, he doesn't care about a other men's interior lives. He just cares about his snug little retreat where he can do his law and get the approval of John Jacob Astor and have everything nice and neat, like a ticking little clock. And by the end of the story, he's totally destroyed by Bartleby. And the last paragraph is just an attempt to try to figure out the tragedy of Bartleby. Maybe it isn't the right explanation, but at least, but he's thinking about this other person and what might have made him the way he is. And to me, the narrator is a totally different person than he was at the beginning. He's been transformed by this colorless, almost ghost-like character, and it's about his transformation.
Mr. Weinstein talked about the difference of narrators, and so I think there is to look at this one quote in here. Do you not see the reason for yourself? I think that actually is we can think about that differently from the narrator. The narrator thinks about it. Oh well, there's something that impaired his vision, but you can say that Bartleby, if you look at it and listen to it, maybe Bartleby, that's his vision. He's had a vision of what is the nature of the world. It's emptiness. And now you respond to this too. Why are you still eating? Why are you still doing this job? Why don't you go stand and face the wall, mm-hmm. and just be content with that? You don't have to do all these things anymore. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. over.
There is a transition in Bartleby in the story that he goes from copying to reverie. It's mentioned, the narrator mentions it a few times, mm-hmm. that Bartleby is standing behind the folding apparatus and he's lost in reverie, looking at the wall, right. but lost in reverie. I thought of Socrates somehow, or Buddha, yeah. or mm-hmm. some other person, but that the reverie was something. Maybe not noble, but something beyond the human that he was looking at, yeah. and that we weren't to pity Bartleby for being depressed, given some drug to make him feel happier. Or
well, reverie cuts both ways. I mean, you know, it seems to me. I mean, I would agree. I mean, I really think, you know, the narrator really, through Bartleby, is forced to confront what he sees as the ultimate futility of existence. I mean, that, you know, this whole thing about the dead letters, everybody rushing around, and it all ends in dead letters, you know, in deadness. And I mean, when Bartleby is dying, you know, he is in a reverie in the jail when he's, you know, he's not complaining about pain from starving to death. But you know, I'm not so sure it's Buddha-like so much as, you know, something, or Socratic is something very negative. What we would see is negative, those of us who value life.
It's a good point.
I don't see how he changes. I mean, what does he learn at the end? I didn't really follow.
The narrator?
The narrator, yeah.
I don't think that he learned. I think he unlearned.
I don't think he does learn, and at least, you know, maybe I didn't follow your reasoning, but it seemed to me that even the dead letter thing, he's saying, well, I couldn't reach him after all. You know, some people are unreachable. Well, what does he learn about himself? I don't know. I think he goes on with a settled life.
Mm-hmm. I think he gets sucked into Bartleby's depression.
I don't think so.
I don't think he's depressed.
I think
Bartleby has a vision.
We get depressed.
We might be depressed, but Tagore wrote a play, 1904, called The Post Office. It's about a dying boy, and he waits for a letter, and finally a letter comes. And he's told, you have a letter. And of course the letter is, now you're dying. Right? I heard about this play, actually, by watching a movie about Janusz Korczak, who worked in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he had his children act out this play before they were, right before, in the weeks before they would be eventually deported for Treblinka. I mean, looking forward to understanding that death can be a friend. Mm. I have to wonder now, did Tagore read Melville?
That's an interesting point, because I think on one level we're making an assumption. Of course, the narrator is a man of assumptions, but we're making an assumption that Bartleby's life is tragic and sad, and certainly the narrator is looking at it that way. But are we Is his life sad? Or is it, you say, the path that Bartleby has taken, the direction that he's pointing, is neither happy nor sad? That it is, that he's pointing in some way beyond good and bad. Is that possible?
Bartleby has no need. He has no need. He's the only person who doesn't have a need. Everybody else, no?
Yeah, he can live on half a dime a day.
He has, he's, the word to describe him is willful. He has needs. He needs to do things his way.
That seems to be the perception of the narrator when he dies and he closes his eyes. The guard says, he's asleep, ain't he? And he responds, with kings and counselors.
Not other dead people, just, yeah.
May I introduce something about Melville himself, because it may be relevant here. Melville writes Moby Dick. It comes out in 1853, and it's totally panned. Nobody understands it. This is the Victorian era, the progressive, optimistic age, and he's writing about evil. And 3 years later, he writes this story, and it isn't long before he himself goes silent as a writer, and he spends the next few decades writing nothing. And maybe, you know, this is reflective of Melville's feeling about, you know, here's this guy, the narrator, who's kind of the kind of a pillar of society in a way. He represents his, the pseudo-Christian society that he lived in. Mm. And they're not able to deal with these kinds of questions. And you know, Melville himself died unknown and wasn't discovered until after World War One. World War One brought an end to the Victorian
What kind of questions are you referring to? The question of evil?
Yeah, the question of evil and the meaning of life and all of these things that we grapple with in the 20th century.
Maybe I could pair them. Sorry, I don't know your name. I'm getting regrets. You're Mr.
Douglas Schaefer.
And
Weinstein.
Mr. Weinstein. Actually, if I compare your two points, that it brings to mind whether this is a, there's a kind of sense of, is there free will at work in this story, or is it fatalistic? I mean, the narrator says, I am by nature X. I am by nature a retiring man. I don't like conflict. Mm-hmm. And Bartleby is by nature, you know, as he's trying to diagnose the situation with him. Mm-hmm. And is there any free will in this story? And I guess let me put it in more concrete terms. When faced with Bartleby's point of view, his way of dealing with life, which is rejection. Not, I want this, but I don't want that. You know, and sometimes emphasizing the not. I would prefer not to quit you, the narrator says. Like, the emphasis on the not. Like, he doesn't have an alternative universe necessarily, but he definitely has a negation. It's not this, okay? So in that worldview, is there free will?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's, I kept thinking about what you said, you know, depression. I mean, you know, in a sense, you know, that's kind of a convenient term, a clinical term to define something. And it implies, you know, a certain passivity because it's something that's happening to you. And I thought, well, you know, the flip side of that would be existential despair, you know, because that's something that is active. And I think that, you know, in a sense, you know, it is a very modern story. I mean, it's like Bartleby really is that, with that pallid haughtiness I referred to before. I mean, he's really kind of taking them. I mean, he's really kind of, you know, you can see Camus or Sartre really liking this guy. I mean, he's really doing something. He's killing himself. You know, it's a real activity. So
you could even flip it around and say that the narrator is the person who's depressed. He's only secretly depressed. And the,
right.
Because he's basically said, I mean, we've talked about comparing him with, you know, Donald Trump or Ivan Boesky, but he's neither of those people. He's a small, he's an insect. I mean, he's got a narrow little confined existence that he wants to place himself in. Mm. I thought the interesting thing we were talking about, the preference, right, is that he thinks he's got found a way to get what he wants, and because he's going to, I'm trying to remember exactly how it was phrased, he was just going to assume that Bartleby was going to leave, and he was going to tell Bartleby, you're going to leave, this is, and I'm going to describe this to you in a declarative fact of the way the world is. And he realizes in the end that Bartleby doesn't proceed by assumptions, he proceeds by preferences.
Correct. That is very interesting, because you've helped me see something in that the narrator is talking about Bartleby as if he's a relic of the past. He's like Marius looking on Carthage. He's staring at Cicero when he's in my office. You know, he's going to be with kings and counselors. He's from a noble, older age. He's not from the modern age of finance and the world we're in right now. But what you guys are helping me see is that actually maybe Bartleby is foretelling a world, like almost like the narrator is Western civilization. And all the theories we have of necessity and will and right and wrong and blah, 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 until we smack up against this rejection. Not some alternate philosophy, just no. Like, it's everything up to no. And what do we do with the no?
And it's not a no like, no, I'm going to punch you in the face. It's a no that you can't react to very easily at all. Because usually you try to figure out, oh, what's this person's weakness? How can I exploit that to get him to do what he, what I want him to do? Maybe he needs more money. If I, you know, I offer him more money, maybe or something, you know, something like that. But he doesn't show any, that's what I meant when I said he doesn't have any needs. He doesn't have any kind of weakness where you can say, oh, well, you know, he drinks too much alcohol, or, oh, well, you know, he's addicted to candies, or, well, you know.
But yin and yang. So there's a no, but where's the, there's a yes, too. And sometimes we all say no, we really mean yes. What is the yes here? The yes is the yes. There's a yes here.
Where is it?
The yes is when he's standing by the window or facing that brick wall and says, don't you see? Don't you see? And say, that meaninglessness, it's okay. It's okay. There.
He says it's okay.
It's there. It's there. I am here.
Do you
and weird, I am talking with it, and I'm standing in front of it.
But do you honestly think, if you said that to Bartleby right now, like, seriously, you sat there, and, you know, you're like, we brought up some clever Buddhist explanation of something. The yin and yang. Sorry, I'm not trying to be patronizing. I'm just saying. And you said that to Bartleby. Do you think he would change anything? I mean, do you think, honestly,
you could
reach him?
Do you want him to? What do you want?
Well, no, but I'm saying any kind of intellectual,
but that is
discursive attempt seems to fail. Well, before the no, before the rejection.
You see it as a failure? You see his life as a failure?
I'm not judging Bartleby. I'm just saying our attempts to, from whatever spiritual hubris we have, you know, whatever we think we understand, and we think, ah, so this is the way in. You know, this is the way into Bartleby. Mm-hmm. Well, from whatever direction we come from, I don't care, east, west, north, south. He says no.
But he says yes. He says, don't you see? That's the yes.
Bartleby,
that's the invitation.
Bartleby doesn't say no. He says, I would prefer not to. It's not a negative. Mm-hmm. It's a form of speech that isn't normal. We don't say... later on in the narrative, he says, I prefer not to. But we're introduced to this phrase, I would prefer not to. Mm-hmm. And that's... It's strange.
It's also
it's grammatically weird. Of course, I know the other thing, but the syntax or the grammar of it, I think, is meant by Melville to sort of stop the reader, give you pause. That's not. That isn't what one says.
It's like the ultimate expression of passivity. He's not even saying no. He's just saying, I would prefer not to, and that he stymies the narrator.
I don't know if it's passive. I think it's something that we're so unaccustomed to that Melville's way of showing that is to put that phrase into Borrowby's mouth.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that becomes the office buzzword, prefer, shows that Bartleby's rejection is a very active rejection.
But I'm saying something different. They have preferences because they're just people. But Bartleby is not preferring. He would prefer. He doesn't prefer. He does not prefer like we do.
To be a little schoolmarmy, if you put in a positive, I would prefer. It's transitive, right? You need to put something after it.
Yes, there's something wrong about the phrase because it doesn't get over into what you expect.
I would prefer if I was blankety blank.
We don't
prefer, right? Is that kind of
is it a counterfactual?
Right.
Yeah, it's not transitive. It doesn't lead to a proper conclusion. And when they pick it up, in the way they can, which is in terms of preference.
But the strange thing is that the thing that he would prefer not to doesn't. How to make that grammatical? But the state of affairs that he would prefer not is negated. I mean, he's effective. He's the most effective person. And what he states he would prefer not to, he doesn't have to do.
Right. But he's totally taken himself out of any of the mores that any of these other people live by. Mm-hmm. And he's put himself in there in this particular kind of way. And he's totally stymied the narrator. And in the course of this, you hear the other scrivener saying, oh, well, throw him out. Give him a bottle of beer, whatever have you. You know, I mean, but they're totally ineffective when confronted by this.
He's actually very effective. He's actually accomplished a lot by commotion.
Oh, Bartleby is very effective. Yeah,
he has tremendous will.
But, you know, I'd like to mention something that you had quoted before when you had read the paragraph about him, seeing this soul, this sort of, in distress and so on. I don't think that the narrator had ever encountered what he might have considered to be someone's soul before in his life. He didn't deal in souls. He dealt in position. He dealt in making life easy for him. He was a very pleasant person within a very circumscribed kind of way. But I don't think he ever, given that he went to church, I don't think he ever gave a second thought to anyone's soul. I think that was really bad.
He says he deals in rich man's bonds, title deeds, and
exactly. So I think this was. I think that accounts in large part for what, why he wouldn't. Pardon me. I have a huge frog. He's sitting right here. I heard that here. So about croaking a little bit. it just seems to me that in the course of that, because he's so outside of the world that what these people are living in. And this is why I would say that it was transformative to him, that he did catch on. He might not have understood it all that well, but he did catch on.
He ends up going on this big trip to Astoria and the Rockaways.
What's he going to find there?
He's
using that to go.
Yeah, I thought he
was Rockaway.
He was in
the
Jersey City.
What
the country?
But those are quite. He traveled actually quite a bit, for maybe perambulating.
Okay. But doesn't Melville tell, isn't part of the point of the end of the story, that isn't Melville trying to point out to us that after all this, Bartleby is actually more learned than anybody else, in the sense that, or more aware of the real realities of life than the other people in the story, and that and then at least in the sense that he knows it's futile, and he does have a tremendous will, but no ability to actually dictate an outcome that he would want.
Did dead letters become flesh?
Well, in this, in a sense, I mean, that we're all dead letters, I suppose.
Unable to dictate.
He says that.
But doesn't he decide his own fate? He chooses to. He prefers to do exactly what he does.
Yeah, but the only fate he's able to choose is death.
Mm-hmm. Well, he does a fair amount during the course of this novel, and he changes. I mean, he starts
I'm talking about Bartleby.
He starts out by coming in, answering an ad, giving full description of his capability as a scrivener, gets hired, does a tremendous amount of work, and then is asked, you know, things do happen to him, he's asked to do a small thing, to copy. And that's when he says, I would prefer not to.
The revolution is when he has to, the four of them have to line up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's interesting. That, it's the first, social
kind of thing. And when he really, that's the real major change that occurs in him, when he absolutely stops working, is after his privacy has been disturbed, when he's been discovered on a Sunday morning. There's something secret about him that he was keeping in. Revealing that made a tremendous difference to him. So,
but would this, could this course have been changed if he'd never been asked to check copy, if he'd never been confronted? I mean, would he simply have been able to go on?
I'm not sure. But I'm struck by the fact that he does respond to external stimuli. And I think that also strikes the narrator as well. He's trying to think, well, what could have driven him to this extreme of insanity, which is where he's musing on the dead letter office.
Mm. Could another way look at Bartleby, since in some ways the narrator and the grub man and other people in the grub man in the jail, the tombs, he seems to evoke a kind of sense of respect. I don't know how to put it in the right words, but one side of me wants to look at Bartleby and say, you know, he's a nihilist. He's attached to emptiness. Like, he's got his head around this notion of emptiness, that, you know, Wall Street's empty. Copying is empty. The whole enterprise is empty. Don't you see? It's all empty, right? And he's attached to that. And you know, and there's a part of me that just wants to slap him and say, yeah,
do it all.
Yeah, it's empty, dude. Yeah, that's true. You got your hands around something. But that's only half of it. That's only half of it. The other part of it is this. We've got to live. We've got to survive. We've got to make a living. We've got, you know, that's part of what it is to be human. And so there's, you know what I'm saying? So there's a part of me is going, yeah, man, you've got something, but you don't have it all.
There are a lot of jobs in the 1850s that were far worse than being a scrivener. It involved a lot of physical pain, a lot of hard labor that really wore you down.
Wouldn't that have been better than this?
This was pretty horrible.
I agree with you on that.
The narrator offered him all kinds of options. He just asked him one after another.
Would you like to go to Europe as a companion?
I like the idea, though, that the thing that sets him off is the social engagement. Mm-hmm. Because you can picture him showing up to this job and saying, I found my inner peace. I found my little piece of the world where all I have to do is this. No one's going to talk to me.
It's
like, oh, I'm going to sit here.
I will be in my bubble. Yeah. And there's no possible way. I mean, I think the question came up, is there any way you can imagine? You can't imagine any bubble like that lasting. Someone at some point is going to say, well, we need to review what you've been working with. Can you mind? And at that point, Bartleby says, That's when the rejection begins.
Correct. And that, it's, I hate to bring in anything outside, but I did meet this fellow once who was like Bartleby. I think at times that maybe Bartleby doesn't exist anymore, but he does. This guy was called Dishwasher Pete. And Dishwasher Pete, he was an educated guy, and all he wanted to do was wash dishes. And he would travel around America, and he had a little zine called Dishwasher Pete or something or other. And I went to interview him one time. He said, I don't want to be interviewed. I said, well, you're an interesting character. You know, I'd love to put you in my magazine. I'm not interested in getting any publicity for what I do.